Welcome to the Global Marketing Show, the podcast for all things international business. I'm your host, Wendy Pease, president of Rapport International and a translation expert. Come along with me today as we talk to an expert in the global marketing world about facing their biggest fears, hearing about mistakes they made or saw, discussing best practices, and sharing fun travel language and culture stories. Well, hello to the podcast, the Global Marketing Podcast. I'm very excited for today's guest because I have known him for a little while now, and he's involved in all sorts of international work. We're welcoming Bill Kenny. He is the founder and client advocate for MEET, which stands for My Expo and Event Team. So we're going to dig into more about that. Because they help B2B growth companies land and scale in the U.S. through conferences and events. He is also the founder of Softland Partners, who I am a member. It's a global consortium of professionals and organizations that help companies expand into new markets around the world. He's founder of Test My Pitch and Networking You. He's worked at the Hartford Business Journal, IBM, and Airborne Express. He has an MBA from the University of Connecticut and a BA in business from Marshall University. Well, welcome, Bill.
Thank you. It's so great to be here, Wendy. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to talk to you about. All right. So starting off, I always like to ask people, what's your favorite foreign word?
Oh, my goodness. Favorite foreign word. My gosh.
Stumping you right off the bat.
Wow. Yeah. Lack of a better one, arigato.
Arigato. Okay. And so what's it mean and why is that special to you?
Well, it means thank you, or domo arigato in Japanese. And it just gives me fond memories of visiting Japan a couple times I have. And Japan certainly unlike any other country you would visit. So it really is a place that's always held a special place in my heart.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's a really good word. And so you do international work. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes when I'm talking to people, they've had some exposure early on in their life to international work. So I'm curious, how did you first get interested, or what was your first exposure?
Well, as a kid, I got to travel quite a bit. I was a competitive sailboat racer and got to compete in races all around the world, pretty much on every continent, I guess, except for Africa and Antarctica. I think that gave me some early exposure to how really remarkable the world is just some of the most interesting people you can meet, and the different cultures and all that. So I think it's probably helped me to lean in more into this work and really to, I think, really be very interested in, you know, internationalizing business as much as possible. I think from a sort of a big thought standpoint, I guess my little lizard brain says, you know, the more we can help people create economic independence wherever they are, the better and more secure our planet becomes. So I think that's probably a good thing.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's kind of our mission is we want clear communications for a peaceful and prosperous world. So you came at it for in economic independence for, mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have a lot in common, Wendy.
We
keep discovering that.
So glad we connected. Yeah. All right. So you've worked with a lot of companies that are coming into the United States and going out of the United States. What do you think the biggest fear is that people have when they're going cross borders?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, there's a lot, certainly a lot of unknown. I look at, actually, the process of entering a new country has a lot of similarity to the process of buying a business. And so when a business changes hands, and you know this because you've gone through it, you know, you think about it on, you know, let's say, you know, the business maybe is being sold today as an example. At 11:59 tonight, the business is Wendy's, and it has employees, it has customers, it has vendors, it has all of these different resources and attributes and so on. And at 12:01, when it shifts over to my hands, it doesn't have employees. It probably has transferred customers, but it doesn't have vendor relationships. It doesn't have any of those sort of those resources, and those, all of that needs to get reassembled very quickly for the business, you know, essentially to go forward on Wednesday. And so I think, you know, in just having been a part of a few business transfers, you go into that and you're going through a very small funnel, and you have to assemble all of these resources really quickly. And it makes me think about the, you know, the fact that, you know, you have to trust your advisors, whether it's your business broker or maybe your attorney or whatever, to make connections for you to a great payroll provider or a great, you know, the variety of resources that you need in order to sort of to be a going business on Wednesday morning. And so I think many of those same attributes exist when you cross into a new market, in that, you know, you're going in, there's all, you know, less information than more, and you're having to make many decisions in a very finite amount of time. And some of them are exceptionally consequential decisions. And so the idea of having, you know, some trusted relationships that can help guide you through that really become very instrumental. And so I guess that, you know, when we think about this process, it's just, you know, it's how do you help companies navigate that in a very reliable and ethical way. I mean, I think that's the kind of the essence of the process, because the failure rate, unfortunately, because there are a lot of challenges, the failure rate can be fairly high.
So I know you're working a lot with, and we'll get into this in a little bit, with companies coming into the United States. How much have you worked with companies going out of the United States?
Actually, really not at all. All of our work is inbound. And so, and really because I think a lot of the same strategies, you know, would hold true. It's just, you know, where we're working on essentially revenue generation, we're helping, you know, people generate revenue here, and particularly through leveraging events. You know, we want to stay focused in a market that we have a great deal of familiarity. And, mm-hmm. you know, there may be a time when we have partners in Europe or partners in Latin America or Asia or somewhere that, you know, essentially deploy our strategy or our you know, template into those markets. But for the moment, our focus is inbound simply because of the market familiarity.
I'm so glad you said template, because that's exactly what I wanted to get. What I would love to hear is an ideal client, one that said, I want to come into the United States, and then how they worked through your template or what they did, because my guess is that that template is the same one that you would be familiar to people here in the United States that you could take and then use to launch in another country.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So, I mean, we look at this as a two-phase process. And really the first phase is certainly to get some traction to begin generating revenue. And that's important, obviously, because it sustains the business, but it also gives the new team, some early victories. So it reinforces their decision to join the company and to continue to put in their daily effort. But the other thing that revenue does is it validates that you're identifying the right customers. And so that's really the biggest part of the first 6 to 12 months is your ability to identify target customers in certain personas, and to be able to convert them convert prospects into customers. And so when we think of that first 6 to 12 months, we think of three things, and it's actually really easy to think of this in a fishing metaphor. So if you think about somebody that fishes, goes through, essentially they make three decisions when they're decide to go fishing. Before they leave their house, somebody that fishes will decide what they want to catch, which really actually sounds like a fairly simple thing until you understand that there are 34,000 species of fish, right? And there are lots of subspecies, right? So somebody that goes fishing actually decides not to catch 33,999 species. And so the intelligence of market entry or even just entering the market you're in and marketing a business successfully is about focus and helping, you know, that in that first 6 to 12 months is helping companies understand where to focus in the new market, be it, you know, Europe entry, Asia entry, or US entry. And so identifying that specific prospect profile or persona that is appropriate and sort of lowest hanging fruit, if you will, for them. And then once you identify that, and this starts as a hypothesis, right? We think, you know, going into this new market, and I just had a call earlier this morning with a Russian company that's looking to come to the US, and we talked about, you know, sort of the you know, what have they learned in Russia? And then, you know, do they have some early hypotheses about who might be the best targets here in the US? And there's really not a bad answer here, because we're going to test it. Whatever the answers are, we're going to test it, validate or invalidate. And so once we have that sort of target customer, then we hypothesize as to where they're going to be. So think about fishing, right? We're going to go where the fish are. If we say we're going to, you know, to catch striped bass, we're not going to a lake. We're going to an ocean. And ideally it's an ocean that, you know, they're in that season. And we're going to fish at the right depth. And then of course the third of the three decisions is, what bait am I going to put in the water? So, you know, what's going to attract that fish and get them to bite. And so, you know, when you think of that first, you know, 6 to 12 months, if we answer those three questions, we can actually hit the second priority of phase two, which is to essentially map the process to create a customer. So if you think of, you know, pre-market entry, you have all these hypotheses. So think of it as, you know, you're in Massachusetts, I'm in Connecticut. If we said, you know, the process of creating a customer is essentially the path between us. The hypothesis is going to be some kind of serpentine road. And it's dirt, and it's going to be slow. And it's going to be, you know, just stuff's going to be in the pipeline.
That's
for a little.
Really good to remember, because I think people want to go into new markets and have it figured out and launch. Like, well, I'm going to have to hire an employee, and then that person's going to make sure that it launched, but it isn't, because there's lots of different ways and lots of cutoffs that you can go at that time.
Well, that's, yeah, the challenge is, if you hire a salesperson to start, and we see this happen all the time, you know, we have and we see it with companies, and 100% of the time it fails. And so we'll see companies hire a sales rep, whether it's bringing them from their home country or hiring a local person. But the analogy is really, it's like hiring somebody, somebody to drive a car, but asking them to build a road. And so if we follow that sort of path metaphor, you know, that idea of going between, you know, where I'm in Connecticut and where you are, and all we know is sort of this serpentine dirt road, that in that first 6 to 12 months, really what we want to do is create a one lane paved road, right? So if we can figure out by doing these tests, who our target customer should be, or target prospect, where they are and what converts them, those three questions, then we're going to be able to know, you know, and empower a sales rep to go out and sell. And then, so then phase two is really about, how do we take that one lane paved road and make it the autobahn, make it 6 lanes, make it 8 lanes, make it 12 lanes. And that's what allows us to scale. Scaling comes from not, you know, having Wendy's sales system and Bill's sales system and Fred's sales system. It's having a company sales system, right? And so, you know, so that we have a process that we can, you know, that everybody can essentially exercise in order to engage and convert prospects into customers.
Right, right. So there, so when you start working with them, there's a lot of pre-work of defining that paved road before they're even hiring somebody.
Yeah, and we would suggest that, it's okay to have maybe one person selling, and sometimes we, about half of our clients, we're their first employees in the U.S., and the other half, we're kind of coming into a running system of some kind. And, it's really ideal that we get that road at least fairly well mapped out before there's, you know, a lot of new sales reps put into the system. Cause you know, ultimately our jobs as managers, as whether it's owners or founders, is to set people up to succeed. And that's, you know, and we can't expect somebody that, you know, doesn't have the background in, you know, developing these systems to go out and do it. They can, you know, they can probably make great phone calls. They can have good discovery meetings and so on with customers, but that's a lot different than the whole identification and sort of nurturing process that it takes in order to scale and convert clients.
Okay, so tell me more about what you do at Meet.
Yeah, so our service breaks down into a couple of areas. Certainly from what I just talked about, we do a fair amount of strategy work. So essentially both sort of looking, helping a company identify all of the events that they can take part in. And when I say events, you know, that could be, you know, obviously we're used to the days of in-person trade shows, but now it's a lot of virtual trade shows as well. Depending, all of our clients are B2B and most are focused on enterprise sales. So we also have some company hosted events. In other words, things like executive briefings. For one of our clients right now, we're organizing some whiskey tasting events that we're going to do virtually.
Fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they're working on some very large, government contracts.
Are they from Scotland or Ireland?
We're going to have some very interesting whiskey, but none, it'll all be domestic, just by the nature of the target customers. There are a lot of ways to engage, obviously. And sometimes it's around, sometimes it's in public and most of our work is in events that we're not running. But once we have identified a good pool of prospects, then we might do some hospitality or executive briefing type events as well. And so, I guess our service really breaks down into two areas. One is the strategy, sort of setting up, you know, if you again think about who the fish is, where they are, and then what are the sort of engagement, identification and engagement tools we're going to use. And then we'll actually do all of the execution as well. So we attend, you know, weekly, we attend trade shows for our clients. We're, you know, essentially identifying prospects. Quite often, particularly early in our relationship with clients, we're doing a fair amount of the early sales meetings with the prospects because, you know, just our familiarity with them. Yeah. And, you know, especially in the Zoom world, it's pretty easy to do. And then we do a whole lot of measurement. So, you know, all of this needs to have metrics and a lot of our work, you know, if people are familiar with inbound marketing online, mm-hmm. A lot of our work is very similar to inbound marketing, only in that we're doing it in person or through personal interaction as opposed to through websites or e-newses and things like that. And one of the nice things about doing inbound marketing sort of interactively with people is when somebody opts in, you think of that term in inbound marketing of opting in, when somebody opts in, say for example, we're at an in-person event and I I'm talking to somebody who may be a prospect and I give them our offer. If they opt in, I can ask them, wow, that's great. We'll get you signed up for that. So what is it that's particularly challenging you right now on this topic? I can get more detail. I can get sort of more context. And then if they don't opt in, I can say, great, no problem. So what? What is keeping you awake at night? But if not this, then what are your bigger challenges? You know, if this isn't your big challenge, so we can do quite a bit of fact finding that that can go beyond what you can do online. I think online is really valuable, but there's I think a place where interpersonal can really add a lot of context to all of your customer discovery.
I want to bring you back to something that I found very interesting. So you have these companies that are established enough in their home country that they've been selling, they have a presence, they're familiar with it. So they've been marketing along the way. Now they're coming into the US and you're having to do a whole marketing analysis for them. Are you finding the companies have already done their marketing research, positioning, and strategy, and they have to restart it? Or do they have a really good thing and they haven't thought about marketing, so when they're coming into the U.S., you're saying, let's revisit it?
It's a good question. So I would say, in most cases, I would say that companies have probably done some view of the U.S. market entry, but it's not complete and certainly not at the detail level we need in order to go and make specific decisions around strategy. You know, we need to, I think, be much more focused. Again, you know, just going back to this Russian company I talked to earlier, it was so funny because, you know, they go, hey, you know, we really are just, and they're kind of a unique case. They're just looking to see, they have a technology that's essentially looking for customers. And so they have some sales in Russia and they've done okay, but they really aren't sure if they found the best customer yet. So, you know, I think it's one of those things where they were very happy to aim at anybody. But when I gave them the fish story, they go, oh my goodness, we can't aim at everybody because that's really inefficient. So, you know, I think a lot of our work is really about,
it's basic marketing. It sounds like you're getting companies, because if they had done this kind of market research in Russia, then you'd just be adapting it for the US market. Maybe some changes here and there.
Maybe, you know, but it's interesting. I mean, we get to talk to fairly mature companies and work with fairly mature companies at times as well. And, you know, not to throw anyone under the bus, but, you know, we worked with one of the big four accounting firms and I asked them very directly, who's your customer? And they went, I mean, I had to stop them halfway through. I said, I really don't know what you're talking about. Cause they couldn't very succinctly tell me who their customer was. They were, you know, and I see this all the time with folks they have prospect creep. I think is the way I'd put it, is they over time they sort of allowed, as opposed to being able to easily prioritize and articulate who they're aiming at, which is not only important for the executives to know, but it's important for them to train the rest of the team. So, because when they go to a trade show, I mean, this particular company takes 20 and 30 people. And so if the people that are leading it, who I was meeting with, are confused, imagine what it's like for the people who are actually executing on the floor. I said, you can't do this. I mean, give me three and that's it. I only want to hear three. And that way your people can go out and get focused and actually, because when you look at any, for example, any trade show floor, there's probably only, if you're at the right trade shows, if you're really good ones that are aligned with you, probably at the most, maybe 1-2% for any of us are prospects. And to be a prospect, they have to have three attributes. They have to have need, they need to have money, and they need to be urgent. And if they're not all three, they may be a prospect in a month or, you know, a year, but they're not a prospect today. And ultimately our marketing is about how do we find prospects today, right? We only want to put people in our pipeline that are have momentum or have some motion to them. And you know, the latent folks will pick up when they're hungry. But there's no reason to frustrate them or waste our salespeople's time with it, sort of we'll just bother people if we're trying to sell.
Right. But what I'm finding really interesting here is that you're talking basic marketing. You know, what fish are you going to go after? What water are you going to be fishing in? And what bait are you going to use?
Yeah.
And so if you figured that out, you know, if I'm going after striped bass here in Massachusetts, then if I'm going over to Russia, I better make sure there's striped bass there.
And again, you may have, there may be other types of industries or customer profiles that would make sense in Russia, because what you'll find as you move around the world is different economies are at different stages in solving problems. For example, I go to a variety of events in the MENA region every year and in Eastern Europe. And I talk to investors about this all the time, because there are usually investors in the room as well. And they'll talk about the companies that are investable in those regions, if the same companies would not be investable in the U.S. because those problems are already solved. And undoubtedly, there are problems
like
that
what
they
kind,
solve.
Give me an example of what kind of industry or investment.
It could be as simple as potable water. I mean, I mean, that's, I mean, but
unless
think
you're
of,
in Michigan, then we still got to
work. Yes, unless you're in Michigan. But I mean, I think there are certain things. There could be telephony items. There could be a variety of lighting or housing items. I mean, I think they're, you know, and again, every marketplace is sort of at different levels of maturity. And undoubtedly there are things, you know, like for example, financial technology, the U.S. imports a lot from Europe and other regions because our financial and insurtech is generally behind a lot of, but and both from a regulatory and an innovation standpoint, we're behind what they're doing there. So, you know, I think each region has its own sort of advantages, but I'd be careful assuming that what sells here and to whom is the same if you travel globally. I think you still need to do that. You still need to do that discovery. And chances are it could be different value propositions that even if it's the same fish, let's say for example, it may be a totally different bait. Because there are different value propositions that, you know, sort of are important to each persona.
So talk to me about that, because a lot of times we'll see companies that have their marketing set out. They know their what fish, they knew the where, the water, and then, you know, they're coming to us for content translation, which is their bait.
Yep.
And so we will culturally adapt it. So we'll translate it and then we'll make it appropriate for that audience, because, you know, the visuals, the colors, the references, how you talk about family. So that bait is changing just as you would, you know, fishing a trout stream in Pennsylvania. You know, they might not go after the royal flies or something.
Right. There are
day.
All sorts of different, somebody that fly fishes has 10 flies they might use in a day of fishing. Yeah.
Right. So you swap those out to see what they're doing. And that's kind of what we're doing with culturally adapting it. So I'm really curious, you know, to hear what you're doing with language stuff. Are they creating, you know, how are they doing it coming into the U.S.?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, obviously here you're really just concerned about English. So it's not like going to Europe where you've got, you know, so many different languages,
right.
You know, and yeah, I think there, and even our UK and Australian clients, I mean, even though what did Winston Churchill say, two countries separated by a common language, and it's sometimes it's language and sometimes it's even just the mannerisms that are unique and different. Between even English-speaking countries, but you know, we don't necessarily get involved in that directly, but certainly have the opportunity to help in terms of directing to, you know, various resources like yourself that can
so,
help.
So, but that's what I guess the difference is you're doing inbound and it's personal connections. So
Correct. There
you're that liaison with culture and language for them. So rather than translating or needing an interpreter, they've hired you to represent the U.S.
Correct. Now, yeah. For half of our clients, I mean, we're them for at least like the first year of their market entry. And it may, you know, it, that varies a bit by company.
So that's a really interesting way. If somebody wants to go to another country, they need to find the meat organization in Russia, China, Japan, wherever they're going, that can help facilitate it. And it's not an employee, it's not a distributor, but it's somebody that can really figure out what fish, what water, and what bait.
And it's a really low risk way, because there's very little infrastructure, if you will. And we have people that are ready to sort of come in, and our relationships are month to month. So people can, our clients have free will to decide that we're not working out well. Thankfully none have, but the relationship is based on results ultimately and production. So, versus hiring people, which obviously comes with a whole, number one, managing that person, and also, how much experience do they have at actually doing this? Where we're bringing, sort of a variety of resources together, hiring one person doesn't necessarily have all of those skills.
Right, exactly. So it ends up being a really good way to gain market knowledge by getting experts on the field. They're really marketing experts on the field.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, I think for some companies, we're a really good fit for sure, and a very efficient fit.
So if you were going to start Meet Russia, how would you go about doing that? And I want to draw parallels to somebody who's maybe a manufacturer or a product manager or something that is going to go into a new market. How would you think about doing that?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think all of our work is demand centered. So, I think here in the U.S., I would identify, maybe one or two target countries and talk to potential customers who might need our support, going into those countries, and then identify resources who could help sort of, if you will, deploy our system. One of the nice things is, we have employees all over the world that are we have people that are doing research in various areas of the world, and people that on our team that are actually going to events all across the U.S. And so we can do a lot of, and I shouldn't say even say a lot, probably all of the strategy work centrally. Having the local person is probably much more about the, if you will, the case or customer management, and having someone in market who can, go to the events, develop the relationships and build a team. So I think the first focus would be to essentially validate that there is interest in going to specific regions, and that there are customers that need our help there, and then second to begin building that team to actually execute the work.
Okay, so it goes back to your platform of figuring out the who. So you'd reach out to customers to validate it. The where are they going to be? And then the bait, you'd find, so you're already used to finding people all over the world. So it doesn't directly apply to somebody who might be new.
Right.
Figuring it out.
And I would probably identify the market that we would next want to support. So you brought up Russia, it could be Russia or, I think what we quite often look at our biggest trading partners as a country, and see what countries are the biggest trading partners from an inbound standpoint, but this would essentially be reversing that. Where are we, where is the most FDI, the foreign direct investment happening from the US? And, it's going to be countries probably like Canada, like the UK, like France, probably Japan, Australia is probably somewhere up on that list. Ireland's probably high up there, but looking at those countries and then we'd find companies that were going, if we picked one or two of those as a focus, we'd pick, then identify companies that are going to those markets and work with the various trade organizations that are supporting companies going to those markets.
Okay, so you've talked a lot about resources. And so in the last year or two, you've launched Softland Partners, which is a tremendous organization. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about that and how that could help somebody who's going international?
Yeah, it's fun. Well, thank you. Yeah, we actually had the idea. It was a year ago this month.
Congratulations.
Yeah, and I'd say I think we launched the website in January of this year. So even taking that, it's sort of been about 8 months. And so what Softland Partners is it's a global consortium of essentially the support community for companies that are internationalizing and entering new markets. And so the support community would be trade and investment organizations. Those most of them or many are government entities or agencies, but there are also some industry associations that do a fair amount of trade and investment work. And how this manifests itself is that, you know, these organizations bring delegations of companies to new markets to help them identify opportunity. There are, you know, every day coming into the U.S. when we're not in COVID, there are delegations in most of the major cities from various countries, and the same thing sort of all around the world in many of the markets. And the other sort of population that's a part of this consortium or community are the service providers that support companies who are internationalizing and entering markets. So you think of, you know, attorneys that help with business formation or contracts or intellectual property or any of those areas. You think of the accounting firms that help with international tax issues and so on. You have, you know, the staffing companies that support employee recruiting and all of the language companies and the realtors that help with site selection and the marketing companies and so on. So the idea and kind of what has really compelled us to do this is this time last year, we were doing a kind of an internal strategy meeting. And as often happens when you do these meetings is it gives you a chance to sort of back away and see things that maybe you didn't see before. And one of the things we hadn't realized before, but that all of our customers over that past year, and in fact, now, still now, have come to us as damaged children. And what I mean by that is they've come to us after having had really horrific market entry experiences. I'll give you an example of an Australian client of ours. An Australian client, before we met them, tried to enter the US twice, failed miserably, and invested in those two attempts $1.2 million in two failed US market entry attempts. So, wow. And some of this happened because they, you know, as we all do, they made the wrong decisions. But in some cases, they also got connected to bad actors who took advantage of them. And it may not have been purposeful, right? Australia's 10,000 miles away. And again, we're separated by a common language. There can be misunderstandings, but in some cases they were definitely taken advantage of. And unfortunately, as we talk to peers like yourself and folks who are in the trade and investment world, we tend to hear that this is not an unusual thing. We hear that our experience at, you know, mostly working with companies who have had these kind of horrific experiences is more normal than not. And so we started Softland Partners really to address that. And now we've grown to we started doing meetups as a part of the, you know, sort of our infrastructure. Our first one was 5 months ago in New York. Since then, we've started, well, we have now going meetups going in 14 cities around the world, which kind of blows me away. So we're as far east as Mumbai, India, as far west as Silicon Valley, and as far south as Sao Paulo, Brazil, and kind of a lot of places in between. And kind of new locations. I just talked to Budapest, Hungary yesterday, and I think they're going to come on board with a meetup. So it'll be hopefully up to 15 soon.
Wow, that's fantastic. Yeah, so that's almost three markets a month since you've launched the
Something like that.
The meetups.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. To see, you know, just even just yesterday talking to the folks from Budapest, is just their passion for the whole idea of internationalization. And they have a very active ecosystem helping Hungarian companies and Hungarian technology internationalize and find markets, whether in Europe or US or Asia. And so, but they also want to make sure that people know about the Hungarian market in terms of entering that market as well. So, unless you're exposed to it, it's hard to understand how much energy there is right now globally to help commerce, essentially cross-border commerce, which, you know, I think.
So yesterday was the monthly Boston meetup mm-hmm. for Softland Partners, and I was there, you were there, and we had Joy Kinnear, is that how you say her last name?
Yes.
Speak, and she made some really good points about even the shutdown during COVID, where we're hearing, limit your supply chains to the United States and, you know, don't go international and seal the borders and all this. She made some really good points about why it's a good time to do global work. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, I think there are probably a couple of dynamics at work here. So I think what she was saying was that, you know, if you take a contrarian view, and this is usually where investors do best, is they don't, if you will, buy what everybody else is buying, they buy the opposite because they know that, you know, that there's generally value where people aren't looking. And so the idea that if people are resisting right now, entering new markets or crossing borders, that probably means that there's some customer demand that's unsatisfied. And earlier I used this metaphor of, you know, sort of if I wanted to come visit you, I'd go to Google Maps and I'd say, all right, you know, here's the route. It's very likely, you know, well, actually now with COVID, probably less likely that I'd run into traffic, but in normal days, I would normally, you know, somewhere along the way, I'd run into traffic. Now I have two choices as somebody that runs into traffic. I can wait, I can be patient, or I can find another route. And so I think, you know, what Joy was really talking about is, you know, there are companies that are saying, I'm going to sort of reinforce where I am. I'm going to, you know, work on my systems and, you know, sort of improve what I'm doing here locally. So when things do open up, I can expand. Or alternatively, there are companies that are saying, gosh, I'm not changing where I'm going. I'm still going to go visit Wendy in Massachusetts. I'm just going to change my route, right? I don't need to go this route, which was probably me bringing employees in or hiring local people. I might work through partners or channel partners or distribution partners or whatever to accomplish that. Or I'm going to attempt to maybe enter slower, you know, virtually and try to engage customers from wherever I am in that new market. And, you know, I think, you know, for each company and each industry, there's probably somewhat of a different answer to this. I'm not sure, you know, sort of waiting for things to get better is always the right answer. I think if you've ever read the book, Who Moved My Cheese?
Yes.
You know, I think, you know, there's some of that now is, as we look at sort of assessing our industry, of course, our core has been in-person events. And I'm very confident if we played this movie 2 years or 3 years out, in-person events will be just as big as they were pre-COVID. I'm less confident over the next 6 months. Maybe this year next year at this time, we'll start looking normal, but the thing that I think will change is the connection to virtual events. I think virtual events are here to stay. I think I think companies are crazy if they're not looking at virtual events as a new part of their portfolio, one of the arrows in their quiver. Because I think, you know, at least what we're seeing with our clients is they're you know, we're able to go to events that we either from a time standpoint, because the travel is too far or conflicted with other events, the cost was, you know, such. But the idea of participating virtually, if you will, if you rank your events sort of A events and B events and C events, you know, you can go to many more of the B events now, do more testing, which ultimately is really important for sort of validating what, you know, what you're going to do and what's going to work besides the actual sales part. And so, you know, I think, you know, and what Joy was saying, it's really about, you know, it may make sense in some cases for you to kind of stick to your knitting and get the, you know, make sure that all of your systems at home are as strong as they can be. On the other hand, this for some might be opportunity that it has a lot less traffic than normal markets. I know I was just on a call a couple weeks ago with a company from the UK, and they're one of our clients, and they're staffing up right now. Sales people in the US, they have a good sales team here, but they're staffing up because it's easier to get appointments now than it was pre-COVID. People are more, you know, more open to meeting via Zoom, and they don't, you know, their travel budget's much less and all that kind of stuff. And they're actually seeing good conversion in their business because they're being much more aggressive. So, you know, there's no one answer, I don't think.
Right. Right. All right. So we're coming up on the hour, and now I'm going to switch it to the personal side so we get to know you. So I've got some questions I'll fire off at you. I'm curious. What was your favorite vacation?
Oh, gosh. Sailing in the Greek islands.
Oh, nice. Not competitively?
No, this was all fun. We were on a friend's 45-foot sailboat and sailing through the Greek islands. And my most favorite place on earth, Santorini, we sailed into. Most amazing, amazing place, for sure.
That is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. All right. How about your favorite memory or most rewarding cross-cultural experience in work?
So for the last 5 or 6 years, I participated in and emceed an event in Istanbul called Startup Istanbul. For this year's cycle, for 100 positions for companies to come in and pitch at this event. It's a pitch event with about 4,000 attendees, a lot of investors and whatnot, but they invite 100 companies from around the world to come in and pitch. This year, they got a little bit more than 200,000 applications for 100 positions.
Wow.
Applications came from like 175 countries. And so I don't know how I lucked into this. I've just become really, really good friends with the organizers. And in fact, one of the organizers is our chapter lead in London.
For Softland Partners. Oh, that's excellent.
Ella,
yeah.
If you met her. But sitting in this, you know, in this environment, you know, you've got, you know, companies from every culture in the world who are trying to both, you know, sort of assure that they are successful locally, but also get into international markets. And certainly Istanbul itself is such a crossroads and such a wonderful setting. But you really have a sense as you're involved in this and in mentoring with companies and all that of the opportunity that is available. If we can sort of continue to support and drive international commerce. I think it's, I think that the more we can help support economic independence, I mean, whether you're talking about, you know, through a lot of the developed world or less developed world, I think for everybody, it has a massive impact.
What a fabulous conference that must have been. How did they handle the language issues? I have to ask.
It's all in English, 100%.
Was it really?
100% in English. Yeah, there are some countries you travel to that will mandate the local language, whatever it is. Most in the business and entrepreneurship space, our focus on English. I mean, wow. Absolutely most countries, I think barring a few exceptions, especially if they're international in focus, they're definitely,
saying is a lot of conferences will say English because the expense for providing interpreters can be, prohibitive for them to cover, but they're losing a lot of their audience because their English isn't as good. So we do have a technology now that can plug into the speaker platform and it goes into an app and the people can get it in a written transcript. Now, the quality is about as good as Google. So it's not, you wouldn't sign a legal contract and you might miss stuff, but with the limited English they know and then reading it, it supplements what they're doing. So,
and is it pretty close to real time in that?
Oh yeah, it's pretty close. Yeah, because it's going in, it's capturing it, it's translating it, and then pushing it out to the app. Cool. So it's really cool for. Yeah. I still think that having the booths and the interpreters and the signs and signals that the speakers and the interpreters can have is going to be a higher quality, but for something like this where they're not using it. So anyway, enough about that. Okay. Favorite place to do business? Zoom meeting,
I'd say the U.S. simply because it's where we focus on doing our business. But there's no unfavorite place. If I were going to pick one, I'd say here.
The U.S. Yeah. Craziest travel story.
Oh gosh. Well, there are some that I can't tell.
those are the ones we want to hear.
I did have an opportunity when I was young, when I was competing in sailboat races, to meet the king and queen of Spain. That was pretty fun.
Wow.
That was neat. It was Ferdinand and Isabella. Juan Carlos and Isabella. Yeah, but they were fantastic and really nice. And they're a sailing family. So they're actually one of their daughters went to the Olympics as well.
So you were actually, were you sailing with their daughter or they were attending the event to watch or?
Yeah, actually the event was in Princess Sofia's name. So it was called the Princess Sofia Cup. It was in Mallorca, Spain. And we were sailing in this type of sailing, there are different size or class boats. And so we were sailing in one of the classes and their daughter was sailing in a different one. So we weren't actually competing with or against her, but they were at the event. Apparently Sophia and the royal family comes every year and gives out the trophy. So we got to meet them through that.
Oh, so you got a trophy?
So
you got a trophy and they awarded it to you. Well, that is a big deal. That's a neat story.
Fun. It was a good time for sure.
Yeah. And have you lived in any other countries?
No, traveled to so many, and I'd love to. I just haven't. It just hasn't been something we've done. But hopefully, in the not too distant future, we'll get that chance.
Yeah,
I have a few picked out.
What you've got? Which ones would you pick out?
I think probably very high on the list. I mean, there's so many really good countries I'd love to live in.
Right. Yeah.
Probably really high on the list though would be Croatia. I just really find that to be, I was there when they were a socialist country. We competed in some sailboat races there. And to go back there, we went back 2 years ago and it's such a remarkable place and wonderful people. And there's so many things about it that are great for sure. But again, my top 10 list would, it's all very close, I think, but Croatia should be on the top.
My screen share has been coming up with pictures of Croatia. It looks beautiful there.
It's really nice. Yeah. We were there during the World Cup and we had a sailboat for a week. It was wild to be in Croatia when they were competing in the World Cup in the finals.
I can't even imagine what that would have been like.
Bars were fun.
Yes. You got a lot of great travel stories.
Lucky, yeah.
All right. What about recommendations or resources for companies that do want to start doing international work?
You know, the first place I would go is, two is whatever government whether it's your country or state or region, finding out what support is available through them and support. First and foremost are, all of the different resources from a standpoint of whether it's consulting or different types of, databases that you can do research. And then your industry association may well have some support as well for export or internationalization. And then whatever countries that you're shortlisting, also checking with them to see what kind of support that they have, or if you've picked out specific regions within countries or states, they also may have really good resources. And that will help you get, I think, started really well. Certainly coming to the softlandpartners.com website, and you can connect our resources either self-service or use our concierge, and we'll help you get connected to whatever you need.
Great. Yes. I thought you were going to end without mentioning Softland Partners. So I was going to throw that in, but I think those are very, very good points, because even some of the states, you can get step grants to help with expanding internationally.
Yeah.
All right. And how can people reach you?
Easy. Bill@meetroi.com. That's meetroi.com, or Bill@softlandpartners.com. Either one is fine.
Good. And are you on LinkedIn? Are you very active on there?
I am. Yeah. Certainly there is easy as well. Although you might confuse me with all the other Bill Kennys, but
Well, maybe if you put in Bill Kenny, KENNEY, and
it.
Meet ROI or Softland Partners, be able to come up. All right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you, listeners, for coming today. I hope you learned at least one thing or had a laugh at something. Tell people about this podcast if they have any interest in global marketing, and you can find it on all your favorite places to listen. We'll see you next time. That's a wrap for this session. A big thanks to you for listening to the Global Marketing Show. Hope you had just as much fun as I did. New sessions launch weekly on all places you find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Play, YouTube, and of course on our website. If you know someone interested in this topic, please tell them about us. Au revoir for now.